Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's Fourth Branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Good afternoon. This is William Hild, a Deputy Director of the Regulatory Transparency Project. We welcome you to another episode of our Explainer podcast series, part of our Fourth Branch podcast here at the Regulatory Transparency Project. Today, I'm excited to be joined by Jeff Olmstead, former Assistant Administrator of the EPA and partner at Bracewell LLP, and Megan Herzog, Special Assistant Attorney General of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. The topic of today's podcast episode is the Clean Power Plan Replacement, a recent announcement by the EPA. And to get us kicked off explaining what exactly that is, I'm going to turn it over to Jeff. So, Jeff, what exactly is this Clean Power Plan Replacement?
In order to answer the question, you have to know a bit of background. Under the Obama administration, the President Obama was very supportive of having Congress adopt legislation to control greenhouse gas emissions, and in particular from the power sector. The history of those legislative efforts are well known, but ultimately Congress did not pass such legislation, and so he turned to EPA to come up with a regulatory approach to reduce CO2 emissions from the power sector, and with a particular focus on coal-fired power plants. The rule that the Obama administration did, the Obama EPA, was called the Clean Power Plan, and it was very controversial. And I won't go into that history in too much detail, but EPA took a section of the Clean Air Act that had really hadn't been used very much, and came up with what I think was a very creative reading of that statutory provision, and argued that they had authority under that provision essentially to reshape the electricity sector. And it was primarily focused on trying to shift generation away from coal-fired power plants, to some extent to new gas-fired plants, but with a real focus being on trying to shift generation from coal-fired plants and making sure that was replaced by wind and solar and other zero-emitting facilities. That, as I mentioned, that was very controversial. It was challenged by something like 27 states, by essentially every industry group in Washington that sort of represents heavy industry. The litigation around that we've talked about for several hours, so I'll skip over that and just say that it was controversial, it was challenged. Actually, the Supreme Court stepped in and stayed that rule, so it never really came into effect. And then when the Trump administration took office, it was very clear that they were going to revoke that rule. And there was a question for a while as to whether they would simply revoke it or whether they would revoke that rule and replace it with something else. And so what we're really talking about today was the rule that replaced the Clean Power Plan. It actually revoked the Clean Power Plan and then replaced it. And this rule is being referred to as the Affordable Clean Energy Rule, or the ACE Rule.
Megan, do you have anything you'd like to add to Jeff's explanation?
Thanks, Will. I thought that was a really good, quick history, Jeff. And I think I would, you know, just add one more point in the historical record, which is the case law, you know, that preceded this in the Supreme Court, including the case of Massachusetts versus EPA, which is a case that a lot of listeners of this podcast might be familiar with because it's sort of part of the standard legal curriculum now. But this was, you know, a case that made its way up to the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court determined that greenhouse gases, which cause climate change and are emitted by human activities, meet the definition of an air pollutant under the Clean Air Act. And if EPA makes a finding that that pollution endangers public health and welfare, then under the terms of the Clean Air Act, EPA has a duty to regulate that pollution under a variety of Clean Air Act programs. And so EPA, subsequent to Massachusetts versus EPA, made that finding, and it sort of set in motion the regulation of greenhouse gases from a variety of sources and sectors under the Clean Air Act, including, fast-forwarding to the history that Jeff outlined, regulation of the of power plants, including coal-fired power plants and other types of power plants that emit greenhouse gases under a section of the Clean Air Act known as Section 111. And so that's the source of EPA's authority to adopt both the Clean Power Plan and this new ACE replacement rule.
Great. So how does this new regulatory scheme, I believe you called it ACE, differ from what was already in place, the CPP or the Clean Power Plant?
Megan, you want to start on that one?
Sure, I'm happy to. And so I can give just sort of by way of comparison, just a quick summary of what was in the Clean Power Plan adopted under the Obama administration in 2015. So the Clean Power Plan included state-specific goals and alternative sort of nationally uniform performance rates for carbon-emitting power plants nationwide. And EPA determined these goals and rates by looking at systems of emission reduction that could be implemented to effectively reduce emissions from this sector. And EPA looked at a variety of things, including efficiency improvements at fossil fuel-fired power plants, increasing generation from the lowest emitting natural gas units, and increasing generation from renewable energy resources. And EPA projected that this rule would reduce emissions 32% below 2005 levels by 2030 and would have sort of four main effects on the power sector. It would gradually increase utilization of the most efficient gas units. It would add new renewable energy generation. It would gradually decrease generation from higher carbon resources, which is a trend that we're already seeing in the sector. And it would modestly decrease overall generation because of the deployment of sort of energy efficiency measures on the consumer side. And so the sort of whole design of this rule was sort of looking holistically at the power sector, at the regional nature of how we ramp energy up and down to meet demand, and looking also at programs that were already in place at the state level and elsewhere to reduce emissions from the sector. And in comparison, and I hope Jeff jumps in here too, the new ACE rule takes a really different tack to looking at the types of systems of emission reduction that can be used to reduce emissions from this sector. So now EPA is adopting an interpretation of the Clean Air Act that, under this new rule, restricts EPA's authority to consider only measures that could be implemented sort of in the way EPA phrases it, sort of within the fence line of the facilities themselves. So instead of looking at the system holistically and thinking about how plants operate together, thinking instead about sort of technologies and other types of practices that could be applied at certain power plants in order to reduce emission rates directly from those plants.
And let me even take a giant step back and say, that's at the heart of this whole controversy. That I don't disagree with anything Megan said, but I would maybe characterize it in a simpler way. And the Obama administration came up with a very creative and well-designed program that was really designed to take business away from coal plants and to shift that to other cleaner plants. I mean, we refer to that as generation shifting, but the whole idea was, over time, coal plants would be used less. Many of them would be shut down. EPA acknowledged that fact. The rule would force that, and that electricity generation would be supplied by other cleaner plants, and under the rule, ideally by wind and solar plants. That was the first time that EPA had asserted that it had authority, essentially, to regulate the whole sector in that way. To say, well, our strategy here is to take business away from some plants and give it to others. The statutory provision that they used had been in place since 1970, And what it had always meant for all those years was that EPA had authority to look at an individual facility and to say what can be done to reduce the emission rate from that facility when it's operating. It's called a performance standard. And the idea is, you know, you can add on a piece of pollution control equipment, or you can change something about the way you operate so that when that plant is operating, its emissions are lower. And the Obama administration had this more expansive interpretation. And I think to be clear about what I think this administration is doing, what they have done and the way they have done it, it's very clearly an effort to define the limits of what EPA can do under the Clean Air Act. And I think there are many in the environmental community who believe that EPA should be able to use the Clean Air Act very expansively to come up with creative ways to deal with climate change. There's others who believe, you know, that EPA really is a creature of what Congress intended. And when Congress passed that act, and what they intended to do with this very narrow focus of saying that what EPA can do is say, well, you've got to do something to improve your plant so that when it's operating, its emissions are lower.
So you've talked a little bit about how this regulatory scheme differs from what already in place. Can you speak a little bit about, you know, why someone might support this new plan and why someone might oppose it? Obviously, there's probably some differing interests involved, and some people may prioritize certain goals differently. But in general, are there implications that maybe you haven't already mentioned that would cause someone to be for or against this?
I'll offer a couple of quick thoughts, and I suspect Megan will have hers as well. I think people and groups that are very concerned about climate change have been very frustrated that Congress has not been able to pass legislation. And they look to EPA to come up with creative ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And so by and large, the states and the groups that supported the Clean Power Plan were groups that care a lot about reducing greenhouse gas emissions. On the other hand, I would say that there's sort of two different types of people who support the new rule. And one is just people who don't place a high priority on climate change. But then I think there are other people, and I would count myself in this group, who really do believe in the constitutional separation of powers, and that, you know, the executive branch only has the powers that Congress gave it, and that perhaps by defining the limits of what the Clean Air Act can do, it will force the various interest groups back to Congress where the issues belong, and that Congress can essentially be forced to come up with an effective way to deal with this issue. So that's, I think, in very general terms, the way I would characterize it.
Yeah, I think, you know, Jeff is introducing a really, you know, interesting concept here, that this case, as it makes its way through the courts, that the real question that we're all going to be grappling with is not really a question about climate change. It's an administrative law question about the Clean Air Act. And this case will turn on, you know, the court's interpretation of what Congress intended in enacting this section 111 of the Clean Air Act. What did it direct EPA to do, and did EPA carry out those duties in a reasonable way here, right? Did it act arbitrarily and capriciously and in an unlawful way? Did it make a rational connection between its policy and the facts before it, and put forth good reasons for repealing the Clean Power Plan and replacing it with its new rule? And I think even within that sort of administrative law and constitutional separation of powers context with which we're all familiar, that there's a really difficult task before EPA here with the legal interpretation that it's selected. So we have a rule that is in the Clean Air Act, which is designed to mitigate the risks of dangerous pollution to public health and the environment, but we have a rule that's essentially doing nothing to address climate harms that mountain of science in the record shows are really urgent and dire. So the ACE rule is, by EPA's calculations, projected to result in carbon emission reductions of less than 1% through the next few decades versus business as usual, as EPA defines it. And on top of that is instituting a new interpretation of the Act, which really reduces a lot of flexibility ability for not just regulated industry, but also for the states that are charged with adopting plans to comply with this new rule and establish standards for the sources within their borders. So we have just sort of a new rule that not only looks a lot different from what was supported by a really robust record before, but which sort of seems to be a real counterpoint to how the system operates and, you know, how we generally think about efficient and cost-effective pollution control programs, incorporating things like averaging systems and cap-and-trade systems and flexibility for regulated entities. So it's really a sort of a new terrain for the CPA.
If I can just mention one point that is maybe the ironic thing about this whole effort, for a variety of both public policy and economic reasons, the power sector has actually gone beyond what the Clean Power Plan required. So, Megan is right in saying that this particular rule only gets very modest reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. Nevertheless, when this rule is implemented, emissions will be lower than was required under the Clean Power Plan because the market and state, regulations and tax subsidies have really fundamentally changed. So that this idea that the goal of the Clean Power Plan was to reduce power sector emissions by 32% by 2030 will easily surpass that goal. And in some ways, what people point out is, as a practical matter, the cost of the Clean Power Plan would have been virtually zero, because the power sector would have done those things anyway. And this new rule will actually likely impose some costs on the power sector. But it does, I think, sort of establish what EPA is and is not allowed to do. So, if Megan and I were just, if we were debating the most efficient way of reducing GHG emissions from the power sector, we would probably be in agreement. But I think the difference is whether, EPA has authority to create those sorts of programs in the absence of a clear congressional authorization.
And it'll make for a really interesting case before the courts here, because we have EPA in this ACE rule taking a Chevron step one position, so arguing that the statute very clearly and unambiguously ties the agency's hands such that it can't consider these types of emission systems of emission reduction, that Jeff and I think would, if you're any rational person who knows about the sector, would know to be the most cost-effective way to reduce emissions, and instead saying, we can't look at those. We have to focus only on these sort of minor efficiency improvements that may actually increase generation from the sources that are most polluting. And so that'll be a really interesting framing for this case, I think.
So you alluded to, more than alluded to, you articulated that the original Clean Power Plan is heavily controversial and litigated all the way up to the Supreme Court until an administration change made the issue moot. It sounds like it's highly likely that this new plan, the ACE plan, will also foreseeably be litigated.
It's already been challenged. And I don't know if there'll be 27 states on the other side, but yes, it's clear that this will be another bonanza for Clean Air Act lawyers.
So do you see the litigation coming mostly from fans of the original Clean Power Plan who want the old plan reapplied? Or you mentioned that the new ACE plan may have additional costs applied to coal power plants that would not have been under the former Clean Power Plan. Do you see them also potentially joining those suits?
So I think the answer to that is no. The administration has adopted the interpretation of the Clean Air Act that the power sector was advancing in the litigation, And so I don't think you will see a challenge from that part of the industry. There's some, without going into all the details, there might be a challenge from groups who support the use of biofuels. But I think by and large, what we've already seen and what I think we'll see even more of by the time the deadline for filing challenges, which I think is September 6th, I think you'll see all the states that supported the Clean Power Plan, as well as most of the country's environmental groups, will be challenging the ACE rule. And I don't know if the Commonwealth of Massachusetts has already filed, but if they haven't, I suspect that you wouldn't be making a lot of news if you announced that they were planning to do that.
Our office has announced that we intend to challenge the ACE rule. But as of yet, the only petition has been filed by the American Lung Association and the American Public Health Association.
Great. Well, is there anything we haven't touched upon that you think either of you think is missing from the public discussion around the replacement of the Clean Power Plan?
Megan, I guess I've been trying to get the first word in. Do you have a reaction to that one?
Sure. You know, I think there's so many aspects to this really interesting set of regulation and to this interesting legal case that probably aren't on the public's radar, but I can sort of highlight a few. You know, one that I think is really interesting is that what EPA has done in the ACE rule versus the tack it took in the Clean Power Plan and in many other historical rules under this section is that EPA is not actually establishing a national standard for emissions reduction by which it will be judging the plans that states develop to implement this rule. So states will have, after the ACE rule takes effect on September 6th, 3 years to prepare and submit to EPA for EPA's approval state plans, which once they're approved will become federally enforceable and which will apply the principles that EPA has articulated in the ACE rule to actual emission standards that are specific to each facility within the states. And without a standard from EPA, there's not a lot of safe harbor for those state plans. So I think we could foresee a lot of litigation and uncertainty and potentially a lot of costs here that would affect both states and regulated industry. And so this is something new, and we'll have to see how it plays out. And another thing that I think is really interesting to note about this is, as I said before, the EPA has taken this legal position that the Clean Air Act clearly and unambiguously dictates the ACE rule interpretation that EPA has advanced. And under this new interpretation, EPA has established as the boundaries of its authority that it can not allow averaging of emissions among plants or trading mechanisms, cap and trade programs within states or among states, or you know, sort of any sort of compliance flexibility like that that we know from a variety of other Clean Air Act programs and that industry has sort of long advocated to EPA that it would like to see in this rule and in other rules. And I think one could imagine over the long term this having really interesting consequences for industry. You could, for instance, imagine a future where the cost of emission control technologies that are implementable at individual sources coming down and a future regime with stricter emission standards and less compliance flexibility or greater variation across states for regulated industry. So there's a lot of implications of the interpretation that EPA has advanced here that we'll see should that interpretation be upheld. And of course, just in general, to reiterate again, the lack of really meaningful attention to address climate change in this time frame when we know from scientists that the clock is ticking for us to take necessary action to mitigate the most dangerous climate risks. So whatever the courts tell us about how the Clean Air Act is to be interpreted, we are now, again, wasting time without real limits on power plants.
So I'm going to disagree with some of what Megan said. When she talks about this creating a precedent that will limit the flexibility that, that industry has under EPA programs. That's not really true. The statutory provision that's at issue here, it plays a very minor role in the Clean Air Act, and it applies to both brand new facilities and existing facilities. The interpretation that EPA has adopted here is the interpretation they've used for 40, some almost 50 years. And it's been in place that anytime you build a new unit, that unit has to meet a certain emission rate. There's never been any flexibility there. That's the way it works. The only thing that's unusual here is that it's now being applied to existing sources. And the only time that this provision applies to existing sources is if they emit a pollutant that is not regulated under some other part of the Clean Air Act. And I can tell you that virtually any other air pollutant that you can imagine is regulated under these other sections that do provide a lot more flexibility. So, again, this seems like a very legalistic issue, but it's enormously important because, again, it comes down to the specific language that, that Congress used and whether EPA should essentially be given a lot of discretion to come up with programs that it believes are cost effective and important from an environmental perspective. I would just add two other things. Megan has said that, what's really at issue here is we're wasting time. We're not doing what we need to do to address climate change. And I view it somewhat differently in that who do we look to do that? And I know that many people on the environmentalist side and in the Democratic Party are frustrated that Congress hasn't acted. But under our constitutional system, that's where the action needs to come from. And I think in some ways the environmental community hasn't really engaged because they've thought that they can get what they need to from EPA. And that's a bit of an overstatement. They certainly support bills, and we've actually seen quite a few bills that are introduced into Congress. But, that's subject to politics. It's subject to a lot of compromise that goes through the process. But I think that, one thing that I believe will result from this is that the issue will be squarely before Congress again. The other reason I say that, people have talked about the importance of the next election, and I think that's absolutely true. And I'm sure either Megan or I could sort of talk through what a new administration might do with the ACE rule and whether they try to resurrect the Clean Power Plan. But the makeup of the Supreme Court has also changed, and I think it's pretty clear that there are at least five justices on the Supreme Court, and maybe more, who would be very skeptical of anything like the Clean Power Plan. So, in some ways, people have looked to this rule as saying, "Well, this," and I've even said the same thing myself. This defines the limits of what EPA can do. But ultimately, what EPA can do will likely be decided by the Supreme Court. And I think, as of today, you would have to say there's at least five justices who are not going to look to give EPA broad new authority unless that authority is clearly given by Congress. And so, I think that's another reason why this set of issues needs to go back to Congress. And I think that's where it belongs.
Thanks, Jeff. And I don't disagree with that sort of framing of the legal question at all. And so, I think the question here will be, is this rule, which in EPA's own numbers does sort of very little to address this air pollution from this sector that the Clean Air Act calls upon EPA to regulate, does the Clean Air Act sort of dictate that outcome? And is that a rational outcome based on what we know about how the sector operates and the history of the Clean Air Act. And so that will be sort of the question front and center before the court there.
Well, thank you both for joining us today to give us an explanation of this change and what may come about on behalf of the Regulatory Transparency Project and our audience today. I'd like to thank Jeff and Megan for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thank you, Will, and thank you, Jeff.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.